Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having some fun on Friday, talking with our president, Chris Check, and with one of our apologists, Joe Heschmeyer, the founder of... Now, it just went out of my
Shameless
head.
Popery.
Shameless Popery. All I could think of was potpourri, and I couldn't get it.
Well, is that an intentional what is it?
It's not an intentional homonym.
Homonym.
But it is.
I was going to say homograph. Homonym, right.
I have gotten some strange searches in the past where people are looking for potpourri like you use in your house, and they discover this, and I have to imagine they're totally mystified.
Well, Joe, I actually think there's a fundraising opportunity. Couldn't you, like, make bags of Shameless Potpourri?
Shameless Potpourri, yeah.
I think one could make such a thing. I don't think I'm necessarily the right person for that.
I think the Catholic Answers marketing department is going to look into this. Shameless Potpourri.
Perfect. Just in time for Christmas.
Yes.
I got to say, Joe's is very new here. He's not new to apologetics, of course. He's one of the world's greats. But we just, when did you, was it March of this year? Very end of March. And still, almost, we don't go a week, certainly, without somebody in the building going,
that was a smart hire.
Is Joe Heschmeyer as good as he seems? Like, this guy is great. Yes. But my main complaint, if you hire again another apologist, ask them if they are addicted to making puns.
Oh.
Because it's just, it's the worst when you're like hanging out with Joe. It's pun after pun after pun. And it almost...
It is a pretty bad punishment.
Punishment. See, that's what he does constantly.
I think that's a mark of a genius.
All right. I want to just, if we have to wrap up anything on National Public Radio's history of abortion in America. I'm going
to
let you do that. But I got to tell RJ in Texas, we're going to get to you in a second. Because RJ called last hour, and I said callers could call and get in on the conversation. So we'll let him bring up a topic. I'm sorry to have made you wait, RJ, but it's hard to resist just talking and talking about Alyssa Chang. Go ahead. Either one of you. I don't care.
He writes the checks. He can go first.
Yeah. I just want to say that this were, and this isn't Alyssa, but it's the... intelligent young lady who writes for the
Linda
New York
Greenhouse.
Times. Right. That word constitutionality, that adjective has got to be the most elastic adjective in politics. Of course, we know the Constitution has nothing to say about abortion.
And
we also know that no serious scholar of jurisprudence thought that the Roe decision in any way followed the tradition of constitutional jurisprudence.
No.
Now, look, I'm not
Justice White, who wrote an absolutely beautiful dissent in Roe versus Wade, said this has nothing to do with the Constitution. Raw judicial power is the word that he used.
But the word that's unconstitutional is thrown around with abandon, and abandon's the wrong word, with just a kind of authority without any examination of whether the adjective obtains or not. I'm not one of these. What did we call the late Justice Scalia?
Originalist?
No, I'm not. I mean, I think the document is good, but if it needs amending, that's good. And the purpose of it isn't to exist for itself. It's to serve the common good. That's the point of any nation's document, founding document. But that word, you know, the constitutional separation of church and state, for example.
Right.
Those expressions aren't in the Constitution.
No. That's become just a verbal tick in a certain way to delegitimize anybody who says, excuse me, but
I want to encourage our listeners, when you hear that, that's unconstitutional or the Constitution, question it, please.
Sure. Yeah.
Fight.
A good question to ask is, what part of the Constitution?
Yeah, quote me.
Like, where is the part of the Constitution? Because, in Roe v. Wade itself, Blackmun, in the majority opinion, makes it really clear he can't answer the question. Like, he explicitly says, I'm going to quote him here, the Constitution does not explicitly mention any right of privacy. And then he goes on to say, nevertheless, individual justices have sometimes found the roots of that right in the First Amendment, in the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, in the penumbras, of the Bill of Rights.
The penumbras.
Yes. Yeah. In the Ninth Amendment or in the concept of liberty guaranteed by the first section of the 14th Amendment. So he's just said, well, there's five different places judges looking for a right to privacy have like suggested it could be found. That is actually a pretty good sign that it's not there. We can't agree where it is, but it's in there somewhere. Seriously, if you think Roe v. Wade is a good decision, go read it. Because even a lot of pro-choice legal scholars think it was terribly decided, not least of which is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, acknowledged it was terribly decided because it has these howlers. So, for instance, a couple other places in there. First, Blackmun says, we need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. And he points out that...
science had already resolved it 100 years before.
Well, I think if you're dealing with homicide, it's actually you do need to resolve it, don't you?
Yes, exactly. That's incorrect. Like, he's granted, like, it's possible in this decision we're going to be killing a lot of people. We don't need to resolve it because it's hard. It's a shocking kind of admission.
Yeah.
But the second is he later on goes, there's always been strong support for the view that life did not begin until live birth. This was the belief of the Stoics. It appears to be the predominant, though not the unanimous attitude of the Jewish faith. It may be taken also to represent the position of a large segment of the Protestant community, insofar as that can be ascertained. Now, go back to the New York Times article saying God has no place in Supreme Court decisions. He's just argued like, well, a lot of Jews and Protestants and Stoics think that life begins at a live birth. Yeah. So therefore, legally, we're going to enshrine that totally unscientific belief imagine that going in the direction to say, well, constitutionally, we have to find a right to a soul because a lot of Jews, Catholics, and Protestants believe it exists.
Bonkers.
A terrible decision.
We have a big Stoic community here in San Diego.
Do we? Dude, I'm a Stoic dude. All right, I think we've done enough on that. I mean,
can I say one more? I know I'm just on my soapbox here, but I wanted to suggest that when we're talking about the Supreme Court, the one thing I wish people would get right, two things. First, there's a difference between saying, I think there should be a legal right to abortion, to I think there should be a constitutional right to abortion, to I think there is in fact a constitutional right to abortion. Those are three separate positions, and it's shocking how quickly people jump from the first of those to the third of those without any careful legal reasoning. Second, the whole history of abortion, which is what we were talking about before the break, is built on two things. Like, the pro-life position is really simple. One, life begins at conception. That's a scientific and embryological, biological question. And two, it's wrong to take an innocent human life. We've always believed number two. Where there's been a question has been a medical, not an ethical or religious question, but a scientific question of whether or not there's a live unborn organism of the Homo sapiens in the mother. And now we know as a scientific fact that there is. And so the whole fact that, like, well, before we had embryology, people didn't know better is just an irrelevant kind of non sequitur. It's like saying, well, I'm going to demolish this house. And then you say, oh, by the way, someone's living in it still. Okay, well, that changes the moral nature of the...
That's not a question we need to address right now.
It's not important to know whether a person's in the house or not. Many people have disagreed.
The reason, part of the reason why I wanted to bring this up, though, and we've done some on our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, and I think we're going to have to keep doing it, is... there are going to be increasing attacks in the media on the Catholic justices, and that is all that is bigotry. Because you will notice that Catholic justices and judges will come down on both sides of this issue. But this is just pure bigotry, what Linda Greenhouse did in the New York Times. Secondly, all the old arguments are getting rehashed. You know, they keep coming back up. And so the problem, I think, is that, you know, old people like us and medium age people like Joe, we've been around this, all these false arguments for why you can kill a baby. But I don't think the young people have, and we're going to have to fight the propaganda for the next 9 months or so.
You have an optimism about this.
I think it's gone. I think Roe versus Wade is over. But I don't know that for a fact. No, but I think it's likely.
And I mean, it's worth pointing out that even if it ends, it just becomes a legislative rather than a constitutional issue, which would be by itself, I think, in a lot of ways, great for the country. But unless you've got a truly like revolutionary court decision where they say not only was Roe v. Wade wrongly decided, but also abortion is contrary to the Constitution. Short of that, it's going to go back to legislature. Yeah,
they won't do that. I can't imagine that. I mean, Justice Scalia said you couldn't do that. He just said that would be a misreading of the 14th Amendment. And maybe he was right. Maybe he was wrong. But I don't think they'll go that far. I think Roe versus Wade is on its way out, though. And then, in a certain sense, the fight begins. I mean, here in California, it will make absolutely no difference that Roe versus Wade is overturned. In Texas or Alabama, it'll make a huge difference. I don't know what it'll be like. You live in Missouri, right, or Kansas?
I live in Kansas.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm a Missourian by birth and a Kansan by the grace of God.
No, I didn't know why I said I'm
both
sorry.
Both of those states could outlaw abortion.
Yeah, the abortion politics in the state is kind of complicated on the Missouri side. But in Kansas, I think there would be a real hunger to see it outlawed, partly because for a long time we had a late-term abortion clinic. And so it really shows you the horror of abortion, that it wasn't these like nice, clean seeming first trimester abortions. It was really ugly, gritty, in your face sort of. The repugnance of abortion was on full display in the state.
Well, I actually think that if Roe versus Wade is overturned, and as Chris is right, I do think it is going to be, it actually will provide the possibility that the United States will remain one country. Because if we don't allow states to decide basic issues, then the country can't stay together. I mean, we just can't. That's my view in the long term. I mean, I'm not talking about next year or the year after, but in the long term, if the federal government is actually an imposition on more than half of the states, then the states will free themselves from that imposition eventually. They'll say, no, we just don't want to be part of this anymore. So I think federalism is actually probably our only hope to stay together as a country. But of course, many people disagree with me on that. We got to take a break. Then we're going to go to RJ in the Republic of Texas right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is honored by the church as one of the greatest enemies of clergy sexual abuse.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
In his time, St. Peter Damian fought against the many vices of contemporary clergy, especially sexual abuses among the clergy. In 1051, he wrote the Book of Gomorrah that is still considered essential reading for fighting abuse today. He died in 1072.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Sorry, RJ. RJ in Texas left us. Said, I'm going to put you on the air when we come back. And he left us. Maybe he didn't like my federalism argument. Apologize. People in Texas don't always like that argument.
I think generally they are enthused. Don't they talk about secession there from time to time in Texas?
Yeah, but secession is – I think they do, yes. But
secession is what you do when federalism fails.
I have my own feeling on Texas is it's been good for Texas to be part of the union, and it's certainly good for the union to have Texas as part of the union. So
I'm in agreement.
Joe, do you want to correct my history?
No, I was just going to vote the most likely to secede.
See, he's always doing that. He's always doing that. California will try to secede if Roe gets overturned. I guarantee you that will become a new fixation here in California. We need to leave the union.
I think it'll be great to see them spinning their wheels on that kind of just pie in the sky sort of thing. Like that's a great way to waste their energies from actually destructive things they could be doing.
Fair enough. All right. But we haven't gotten to the most important story of this week, and probably the most important story of our time. We did cover Columbus Day and the canceling of Christian figures. We did cover abortion and the maligning of Catholics when it comes to abortion. I have to say, it's wonderful that Catholics have and Protestants have become allies in the pro-life battle. I think it's one of the good signs for our times. But clearly, the most important story of the week, and as I said, probably the most important story of our times, is that William Shatner went to space this week. Captain Kirk actually got in a rocket ship and went to space.
Did he actually go into space? What is space?
What is space?
It's a gap between two letters.
Yeah, what, I mean, like, aren't there atmospheres or something that you got to get out of? Or
Karman line, it's called, and he went past the Karman line.
Okay.
So, but I don't know if that is, maybe that's just a human construct, but I think it actually has legal standing so that you can fly above the Karman line and you're not in someone else's airspace. It's not a violation of another country's airspace. So that's what we say, that's where space is. Is that right, Joe? You're the lawyer.
Well, I'm just thinking, technically, we're all in space right now, but we're just not in like what we call outer space, like the space away from the atmosphere. And yeah, I didn't know about Karman line. I just looked it up, and you're totally right. It is 62 miles up, and it explains that we can have things like satellites circling the Earth without it being like a violation of airspace.
Yeah. So then you get your astronaut's wings if you go above that. But I don't know if you go in an automated spaceship if you get your astronaut's wing, if you're for just being a passenger.
Are you looking for an opinion on this William Shatner thing?
Yeah, I know you don't approve of
it. It's a capital waste of money. And
Come on, have an opinion.
Yeah, there, all of it.
All right. Yep. What would you do with the money? Say you're Jeff Bezos and you know.
I know. Pay my employees.
I have to agree with that one. Yep. Yes, I agree with that. Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, I mean, St. John Chrysostom says, like, the excess that you have is taken from the mouths of the poor.
Yep.
And that it's actually owed injustice. It's this idea of the universal destination of goods, that, like, the goods of the world don't exist simply for your private enjoyment. Now, private property is not wrong, but private property is not an absolute either. No. That has been Catholic teaching from day one. Very explicitly the kind of thing Jesus talks about. So when you have the kind of the barons of our day literally flying to space while you've got people working themselves to exhaustion in an early grave in those companies, in the case of Amazon, it's pretty shockingly tone deaf. Yeah.
I think it's gravely immoral. It's one of the it's one of the sins that cries to heaven.
It is, yeah, that's right. And the worker is worth his wage. And the fact is that obviously these billionaires or multi-billionaires, I don't even know what you call them anymore. They're all 100 billionaires or something, centibillionaires. They're obviously brilliant and talented and capable people.
Is that true? Is that?
Oh, I think so.
I guess some of them are, but I don't know if that's.
I've been trying to make $1 billion my whole life, and I've got $87 in the bank. These people look like geniuses to me.
No. Chesterton says to have all that money, you've got to be dumb enough to want it.
Well, I'm dumb enough. Joe, what were you going to say?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Like, the one thing they'll never have is enough. There's no reason. Don't mishear what I'm about to say, people listening and thinking I'm some sort of like super commie here. There's no reason to be a billionaire. Like, there's nothing you're personally enjoying at $1 billion that you couldn't have enjoyed a whole lot short of that. And the actual costs on you as a person, on your family, are real. That's the first thing I'd say. Second thing I'd say is, like, when we're talking about this, there are real moral parameters. When we talk about like a just wage, we talk about, you know, a worker like deserves their wages. Well, a lot of people have taken this idea that whatever you decide between the employer and the employee,
no,
that's automatically a just wage. Yeah. And that's garbage. And you're not wrong. On an equal playing field.
Right.
So in Rerum Novarum, Pope Leo XIII says that a workman's wages should be sufficient to enable him comfortably to support himself, his wife, and his children. That's a good standard. Like, you should not have to have a two working parent household. And you should not be like forced to like check every month before the paycheck comes in to see if you can make ends meet.
Right.
That's a good. I mean, as long as you're doing what you should be, he talks about practicing thrift. You know, like, obviously as a worker, that doesn't mean like go on expensive vacations to space yourself. But it does mean like someone who's being reasonably responsible should be in a position where they're not sweating finances if they're working full time.
By the way,
that's what a just wage looks like.
And Joe, you probably know or Cy better than I, but that condition that you describe, Joe, represents or is represented, I should say, by a significant percentage of the population of the United States.
People
living paycheck to paycheck.
Oh, absolutely.
Or three paychecks or four paychecks away from destitution or losing.
Oh, I think for many people it's one. I think for many, many people. I mean, here in California, I know we're the richest state in the union, and the poverty is unbelievable in this state. And you know, we have cruelties against the poor in this state that are just numberless. Among them, we will not build housing. So if you want to have a two-bedroom apartment here in San Diego, you better be ready to pay at the minimum, like not in a good neighborhood or a nice spot, you got to be ready to pay $2,500 a month. That's an insane amount of money for someone who might say, well, you know, we want to have more than one kid. You know, we want to have two kids. We want three kids. So the cruelty of the way the economy currently functions toward the poor is immeasurable. I think immeasurable.
Yeah, in that sense, I think your space story is, in fact, one of the significant stories of our age.
That was my insight.
Yeah.
I didn't see that. Go ahead, Joe.
It is an incredible show of just like an excess of money. Like, you have nothing better to do than literally to fly to space.
It's a vanity.
And then make a big show. It is an incredible vanity. The fact that it's become this kind of mini space race where like this is just what you do when you're super rich and wealthy and bored, rather than paying your workers a just wage. This becomes even more egregious when we start looking just at U.S. workers who are in a bad position and start looking at like international workers.
Sure.
You know, places like Apple, when they're installing suicide nets in their factories overseas because workers are getting so like destroyed in their humanity that they're wanting to jump to their deaths, that's a really good sign something is very fundamentally wrong with the way that we're conducting ourselves.
But I mean, there's very little conversation. I mean, and you almost can't have this conversation because then people will, it touches on too many of the sensitive issues about the sexual revolution. But a society should be, its primary priority beyond, you know, basic defense of the society so that it can actually exist. Its basic priority should be the well-being of the natural family.
Yes.
And that's not even on our radar. If you said, what's the, you know, number one issue? Even for Christians, I think many of us would say, well, it's abortion or something. And it is in a certain sense. But we don't, as Catholics, stand up enough and say, look, this is what the Catholic Church teaches. This is what Christ himself teaches, that a society that won't care for and make it possible for the natural family to exist in a way that is healthy for and wholesome for all the members of the natural family is dead. It's a dead society.
You know, Cy, there are a lot of reasons right now for the retreat from marriage, or I guess really we should just say the rejection of marriage, which is what it is now. But we should not underestimate the influence of the financial uncertainty that young people feel.
Sure.
Sure, marriage is absolutely a risk. And I say to any young people, go ahead, do it anyway. You should. But that is a genuine concern. When I got married, I had relative certainty that I was one day going to own a home. But that is not.
How can you own a home in California? Yeah. I don't know how they do it there in Kansas and Missouri.
Well, by the way.
But in California, there's no young person who's not two people working for Google.
Or their parents have helped them out.
Right,
or
that are going to buy a house here. Right. It's just not going to happen.
Right. And actually.
Well, millennials own 3% of total U.S. wealth.
Yeah.
3%. Well, now, millennials often get misunderstood as a group. We're not talking about like kids fresh out of college. We're talking about people my age. 3%.
Right.
Of U.S. wealth. And within that chunk, something like 5% of it is just Mark Zuckerberg. But like he controls like 5% of millennial wealth individually.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you take those tech billionaires out.
Good for him, though.
But
it's a landless class of people.
It's awful.
You know, you're talking about like the collapse of society. You can't have an entire generation of people who have been shut out from the basics of property ownership in their own country.
Yes. No.
And expect that's going to go well for the future of the nation.
No.
Or, like you said, for the future of families. It's insane.
Right. No, it is insane. And now we have this phenomenon in California. I'm sure it's in other places around the country as well, where a house goes on sale for $1 million. A house that sold for 20 years ago sold for $150,000 is now on sale for $1 million.
And it's bid on.
And it's not bought by people. It's bought by large corporations who are accumulating hundreds of thousands of homes. Like, that seems to me a basic injustice. My kids are not going to be able to outbid whatever hedge fund is buying that house. They can't do it.
No.
So why are we permitting it? And so all of this came out because Captain Kirk went to space. We had this conversation.
I'm glad you brought that up. Sorry.
That's how much fun we have here. All right, more news of the world and a Catholic response to it right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Well, I'm not bringing up space again. I got shouted down by Joe Heschmeyer and Chris Check, our guests. Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers and a very fine author of a whole bunch of books, including A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. And the year of St. Joseph is not up yet. Do you know when the year of St. Joseph ends? Does anybody know? Is it on the first day of Advent?
Yeah, in December.
Yeah.
No, it's December. It's on the Immaculate Conception.
On the Feast of the Immaculate Conception?
Yes.
Okay. You should give us that day off. We should get the Feast of the Immaculate Conception off. We're Catholics here.
We get all the holy days of obligation off at Catholic
Answers.
I forgot that. And actually, thanks to Carrie Beck.
But I got to work on Columbus Day.
I do like work.
He's not a saint.
I just wanted to say thanks to Carrie Beck, who scheduled carpet cleaning today.
Yeah.
Pretty much the entire staff got Friday off. I know they were all working from home, right? See my air quotes here?
Yes. Oh, I see them.
Yeah.
Because I did a lot of air quote work at home myself today.
The whole Catholic Answers staff was working from home. Of course, the radio guys have to be in.
Yeah, well, we're what are we, Darren? We're just soldiers. We're soldiers for—
But the carpets look a lot better. We got all those wine stains off.
There's no wine stains. Don't say that. People are going to think that. From the— We don't spill our wine. We would never spill it. All right. I want to just shift gears just a little bit because my attempt to promote space travel was an utter failure in the last half hour. So okay. So here's what I wanted to talk about. And it's a little more complicated to talk about, and so I needed your big brains to talk about it. But our friends over, and they are our friends, over at thepillar.com.
PillarCatholic.com.
Yeah, PillarCatholic.com, right? The Pillar is the name of the publication, where they do some really extraordinary, hardworking reporting that I admire myself very much. I mean, I really, as much as I like National Public Radio, I really admire journalists who work. And and so that's what they do over there. And they have a really fascinating report that I hope everyone will go and read about the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, Ohio. And you both read the report. Let me just, it's shocking in a certain way when you read it, but they're going to close 70% of the parishes in the, either, is it diocese or archdiocese?
Now Archdiocese of Cincinnati. And yeah, that's 7 out of 10 parishes are going to close.
He had to explain that to me because he knows I don't know what 70% is.
Well, I think, you know, when you say it that way.
yeah, that's a lot.
It's staggering.
Right, it's staggering.
It's staggering. Now, there are some mitigating realities here.
Having to do with the history of that part of Ohio and the migrations of Catholics in and out of the state of Ohio. But other things involved as well, you know, people not having a lot of kids.
Yeah. Let me just start here, Cy, by encouraging everyone who listens to Catholic Answers Live to sign up for The Pillar.
That's quite an endorsement.
I've been following. Well, it's our friend J.D. Flynn.
Yeah,
he's on the show from time to time when we do Church in the News, and it is serious journalism. And this piece, which is his colleague there, Mr. Hodges, right?
Yeah, Hodges.
Yeah, Brendan Hodge.
Yeah,
Brendan Hodge. Together,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. Is an excellent piece, not only of journalism but analysis. Of the contraction of the Catholic population in Cincinnati and what His Excellency has to do about this. And I understand the plan in a very limited sense, but when you no longer have a population that can support that many churches, you have to do something. And he intends, among other things, and I'd be happy to have someone from Cincinnati call and correct me. He intends to get more priests living in common.
Yeah.
Which you know, there like I say, there are a lot of currents here or cross currents. The retreat from marriage, the decline in the birth rate, the aging population in Cincinnati Catholic population. But you're right, Cy. You know, that cathedral in Cincinnati in the first part of the 19th century had a nickname. They called it the Bishop Factory.
Because they produced
because
so many bishops.
So many bishops were consecrated there. Lamy, became the first Archbishop of Santa Fe. Everybody made their way through Cincinnati.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one part of me reacts to a story like this in part with a sense of let it go. Like if a property is not serving the gospel, is not serving, then let it go. Like we really it's dangerous for us to become too attached to material things, even when those material things have served a sacred purpose for more than a century. That because I remember what happened in Boston when they downsized in a much more mild way than this. And Catholics occupied these churches and said things like, this is our church, not the bishop's church, which I believe made them immediately into Unitarians and not Catholics anymore, or at least Presbyterians. And so, I mean, I don't know whether any particular bishop, and I don't know if it's right or wrong what's happening in Cincinnati, but my starting point is not to think of this, not to be have tragic feelings about it, but to say, let's get on with the work. And if the bishop feels that we're better served with fewer properties, and if it's not grossly wrong, let it go. Don't worry about it.
The tragic feelings we should have are the demographic realities that are causing the decision.
Right.
Okay, there we go. Okay, fair enough.
It's a symptom. It's not actually the problem itself.
No.
In fact, if we don't do something with it, I think it actually accelerates the problem. Because, like, right now there are either 208 or 211 parishes in Cincinnati. The plan is to get it down to 60 parishes, which, as you said, is a 70% decline. But if think about it, either having 60 like vibrant parishes or 200 parishes that are like a third full, those both have spiritual effects. You know, there's a classic kind of idea in public speaking that you want a room that's a little too small, yeah, because it means that the talk feels a lot more energetic than if you like overplan, expect 1,000 people and 100 show up. Well, now it feels empty and it feels dead. Likewise, like the mass, inescapably, it works that way as well. That if you have this cavernous space and 100 people show up for mass, it's hard for them on a human level to kind of have that same spiritual experience. Now, I know that's not the reason to go to mass. You don't go to mass just because everybody else is there. But St. Paul says, do not abstain from the assembly of the brethren, because he views it as a sort of injustice to others if you're not there. There is some effect that the actual gathering of the ecclesia has. And when you aren't really gathered because the church is much bigger than the demographic, it does have a spiritual effect.
My guess is in Cincinnati, Joe, however, it's going to be the churches with the considerable capacity that are going to be the ones that are kept.
Yeah.
And there are some magnificent old churches
in Cincinnati, in that Over the Rhine neighborhood, for example. Beautiful, beautiful old churches, the sort of the neo-Gothic. One of the things, I mean, the report raises a lot of questions. Why, right? And trads will blame bad liturgies, and I think there is a lot to
It's not just trads that will say that. The Pope, no one says the Pope is a trad, and he says that.
He says
bad liturgy is
very
a big problem.
Bad liturgies, bad music, bad preaching, and limp preaching, we could say. But what interests me, and I have a thousand questions about this, because there are parts of the country where the Catholic population is growing, and Riverside County, for example, is cited in this study where more registered Catholics more and more every year. A lot of that, of course, is immigration.
And Carlo and Jacqueline.
Yeah, right. But
they live in Riverside County.
But Wichita, Kansas, they are building churches and building schools in the Wichita, and Joe could speak to it better than I can. So it isn't simply immigration that's underway. And then why? That's something that needs to be answered. The other question I have is, what is the effect this is going to have on the clergy? Now, I think if we do get men living common lives, where they got to be there for dinner four nights a week or something, and maybe we're going to say the office 3 days a week together, whatever it is, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
With common life, because that is one of the great tragedy or just disasters of our current age. All these priests who live by themselves.
Are alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be living alone. But is it going to make life easier for the priests? I hope that's one of the objectives. Easier is the wrong word. Is it going to make them better able to do their job, to bring the sacraments and to bring the gospel to people? So those are just a couple of questions I have.
I think the answer to that is a resounding yes. You know, the Oratorian model is built on this idea that you have at least, I think, 4 and up to 12 priests and seminarians living together in one place. That's my understanding, at least, of the Oratorian model. And I know a lot of diocesan priests who, having experienced the incredible loneliness of modern diocesan priesthood, have looked into that model and explored it as maybe a remedy to some of those problems. It gets hard to do in a diocesan structure, but something like this, where the ordinary is really supporting grouping priests together, it's worth pointing out, this is going to be a tough transition for a lot of older priests who have been living by themselves for a long time.
Right.
It's hard for my 1-year-old to have a new baby in the house. It's a lot harder when you've been living 50 years by yourself to suddenly have 4 roommates.
Yeah.
But it's really spiritually important, and I think it's a big check against a lot of the attacks of the enemy.
Yeah.
It is, but I also think we have to be, I mean, there has to be some respect for those priests, because, you know, we Catholics, I think, invented the term formation, and there is a formation that comes with living, having a responsibility for a parish for 30, 40, 50 years where you're the sole priest there. And it's not really fair to say, well, that we don't value that formation. And, you know, now you got to fit a square peg into a round hole. But certainly, as we form younger priests, I'd agree with you, the Oratorian model is a much better way.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere, man is not meant to live alone.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But these, I mean, many of these priests don't. You know, they have a social life with their own parishioners.
But a lot of them live alone.
Yeah,
they live alone in their rectory.
Yeah,
they live
right.
alone.
Yeah.
We have parishes here in the Midwest where you might go half an hour in any direction and not see another Catholic parish.
Or if it's a modern rectory that is one built in the post-conciliar age, it's not a house but kind of a amalgamation of apartments.
Yeah, right.
So even if there's more than one priest, they basically live lives alone.
We have to take a break, and so we'll come back and continue our conversation about this fascinating report on the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. But also, we didn't talk about the larger demographic trends, so let's try to hit that a little bit when we come back, because there's a lot of that in this report as well. Right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I always have so much fun when Joe and Chris are here and we do these panel discussions, and I hope that you enjoy it. It's an opportunity to dig into things in a different way than we usually do, and Friday is a good day to do that. And so let us know what you think. If you don't approve of all this chit-chat and you'd like us to go back to just letting Joe answer questions, which is what we hired Joe to do, then that's fine as well. But you can always send an email over to radio@catholic.com, radio@catholic.com. If it's a negative email, just send it to send them all to radio@catholic.com. I was going to make up a website.
President@catholic.com.
Yeah. So just tell Chris directly how much
I don't think that email exists.
All right, so we're talking about this big report that's in Pillar today, a very fine Catholic publication where they do a lot of deep dives journalistically. Also, be careful about what apps you use with around these guys, because they I'm sorry. That's a little reference to what did they do? They use some metadata from
Monsignor Burrell thing.
The Pillar.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. So that made me. Oh, I got a little queasy when they did that. But they do all kinds of other things.
I like that you're just dancing on a third rail here with like 10 minutes left in the show.
Well, I don't want to talk about it.
You know what?
Let it go.
I would love to get JD on the show to make the moral defense for that. I mean,
let people ask him questions. Yeah, I'm sure that would probably be good for him. But I thought there was more reporting coming out about that. So I kind of just went, well, let's see where this goes before we invite JD on. But I think that has run its course.
I have questions about it.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people, I mean, and they're good journalists, and
they are.
And it's easy to talk to them about these ethical questions. And so that I'm sure they'd have no problem with it. But all right, sorry I stepped on the third rail. But they do great reporting. I have my most vociferous support for them has been around financial reporting. It's hard to do financial reporting on the Catholic Church, and they do it.
Yep.
And that means reading a lot of documents, spreadsheets in Italian. And, you know, you really got to be devoted to do it. But, okay, so we're talking about the big report on Cincinnati. I want to let a caller on because we have a caller from Dayton, Ohio, which I believe is in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. So do you mind if we take a caller, or do you two need to? I'm glad you're not such prima donnas. You won't let me go to the
phones. I like callers.
Will you help me put line two on? Okay, line two. Let's go to Terry in Dayton, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Terry, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
And you wanted to say something about the parishes closing in Cincinnati.
Well, yeah, I'm a deacon. And
wait, oh, Terry, a weird thing happened. Did you say you're a deacon of the archdiocese?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Okay, all right. You just dropped on us for a second. Okay, go ahead, deacon.
Okay. During this Beacons of Light, which is what this process is called, they're going to look at parishes based on demographics and number of Catholics, and they're trying to define, not necessarily close all the parishes. What they're doing is going to a parish family model where there like in my parish, there'll be three parishes in one parish. And so each of those churches will still be potentially active based on whether or not they can they're viable. And they would then come up with their own decisions about where masses might be. And there's an allocation of priests to that parish family.
I see. So that would also allow some priests to live together as well in serving those.
They could, yes.
Yeah.
It's not forcing them to do that, but they could.
Well, we've just become exposed to this from reading this article. I don't know if you read the article, but what's the general feeling in the archdiocese? Are people afraid of this? Are people are ready to do it? Or what's the feeling?
I think they see a necessity for doing it because the number of Catholics are decreasing. And the population, I mean, people are moving out of like Ohio and going to south and west. As far as Catholics go. So what they're trying to do is go to a more evangelization model where we come away with our mission would be evangelization versus maintenance of our parishes. And to do that and to try to help the pastor to get out of doing more administration, they want to try to do this family of parishes.
Fair enough.
As,
okay.
as a model.
That makes sense. Either of you wanted to ask?
I just wanted to say one of the points, and I think, Cy, you mentioned that we wanted to talk about some of the demographic forces that are behind this, and that really is, I think, the important matter. But one of the points that the Pillar article makes is that there has always been an unusually high ratio of church buildings, if you will, or churches to the population.
Yeah,
I mean, you've got particularly in the downtown area, and Milwaukee is like this is too. I mean, there's a neighborhood on the south side of Milwaukee where there's Polish and then the Slovak.
Oh, that's
then,
the other thing, the ethnic parishes.
Yeah, and then the Italian, and you can walk to all of them.
Right.
And so Cincinnati has always had a very, very high number of that ratio to number of churches to the population has been higher than, for example, in Boston even.
Right, and in Boston, that would like the town that my father grew up in, Milford, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. There is a Irish Catholic parish, and a stone's throw away is an Italian Catholic parish. And in most of the world, that never happened. That has to do with the way American immigration worked, primarily in the 19th, but also in the 20th century. Bringing communities together who didn't share a language and didn't share a culture. Joe, did you want to say something? You look like you wanted
to say. Well, yeah, I was just going to say I was actually in a parish meeting about an hour west of Boston with my brother-in-law, and it came up that this parish was actually a consolidation of a few prior ethnic parishes, and that it had been kind of painful for some of the older congregants.
Sure.
Because, like, some of the French Canadians had grown up where they would actually cross the street rather than like going next to the Italian parish or whatever. I mean, it was just like they didn't consider them.
There's the gospel in action.
Yeah, exactly.
There's the beauty of the gospel.
They became one parish, but very much in the way Cincinnati, it sounds like, is doing it, where it's one parish that maybe meets in different churches. And it's an interesting kind of balance to tread. I'm hopeful.
Something else I hope in justice that happens is because there will be churches that will be closed and there will be beautiful pieces of art available. And if there are other parts of the country, for example, Wichita, where there maybe are some newer churches, but could benefit, or churches are being built.
Why don't you say San Diego? Have you seen some of our churches?
Oh, I know. We could.
I was going to say the Archdiocese of Los Angeles has a cathedral that could use some.
But the Archdiocese of Los, I got to say, the Archdiocese also has some beautiful churches.
Yes,
some really beautiful churches. It just depends on what era they got built in.
Yeah.
I hope in the
interest of the environment, you know.
Yeah, let's recycle some of these pietas. Okay, fair enough.
Well, I know my son Alexander just got married in a parish in St. Paul, and the windows all came from Boston. It was beautiful, brand new church. 10 years old. Windows all came from Boston. It was beautiful.
In all seriousness, that is a good thing to keep in mind, because it isn't just like there's decline. It's that in a lot of cases you have the urban areas are no longer as Catholic as they were. In many cases, like businesses have kind of come into formerly residential areas, so they're just not as populated as they were. And so you start building where people actually are. Why not take as much of this sacred everything that you can? Yeah. And especially, you know, in the age of COVID, an altar rail is a good way to avoid face-to-face contact.
Nice pitch for the altar rail.
Increase the spread.
Amen. I'm with you on the altar rail, man. You know that I want that altar rail back.
If there is a church in Cincinnati that wants to donate their altar rail to Catholic Answers,
we'll take it.
Yep.
Deacon Terry, thank you very much. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
We're going to migrate now from, as many people are. This is just follows the pattern here in the United States. We'll go from Cincinnati or Dayton, Ohio, to San Antonio, Texas. Leonard's not there? Okay. Sorry. I made a mistake. Sorry. There is another trend, however. I mean, if it's just a matter of moving from, there used to be all these Catholics in Ohio, but they don't want to be in the snow anymore. So they're going to Texas and California and Arizona.
Atlanta,
where there's growth. But that's not the only thing that's happening.
No.
There's a serious question about whether they're continuing to be Catholics when they get to Southern California or West Texas or wherever.
Well, this report did say registrations at parishes. I mean, that was the data that they were using. So that is a kind of an indication of whether someone's practicing or not.
I think
maybe the broader point is, even if registrations are going up in places like Atlanta, it's up 370%. The overall story is one of decline.
It is.
You know, in the same way that like retreating troops might temporarily mean that the number of troops in an area is higher.
Right.
But the overall
still
story
retreating.
Is still a bad one.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And a 370% increase of Catholics in Atlanta, Georgia.
That's right.
Is, from in 10? Real numbers.
Right. A family of eight moved in.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. One Catholic Answers family moved in. I mean, but that is making a difference all across, here in Southern California, not so much because there's a history of Catholicism here because of Mexican Catholics, and because we were Mexico for a long, 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 long time. So Catholics have been here long before the non-Catholics got here.
I had an extensive conversation with the Bishop of Dallas about a year ago, and he described the population growth in his diocese. And he said, you know, because Texas was not really a big, although originally you had to be Catholic to move there. That's what Mexico said, but nobody paid attention to it. In any case, a lot of his growth has just been people from the Northeast. You know, we tend to think of it as Hispanic or Latino. It's just it's people moving from the Northeast into Texas.
Yeah, and then you think
or
of the growth
from California.
Yeah, right.
Now more and more Catholics are leaving California and going to Texas. That's right. But there are dioceses that are bucking the trend, and I really think we should pay more attention to them.
Wichita.
And I think part of the reason we don't pay more attention to them is they don't practice the brand of Catholicism that that the press likes. Traditional Catholicism, with the traditional morals of the Catholic faith and the traditional liturgies of the Catholic faith, it sells. I mean, people want it.
Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yes. Lincoln, Nebraska, 22 ordinands in a 3-year period, and a diocese of under 100,000 Catholics.
Yep.
I would hate to think there are people who would let the church die rather than admit that the Catholicism that people want is the old-time Catholicism, but I think there are actually some people who would prefer to see the church die than to admit that. Joe Heschmeyer, apologist at Catholic Answers, the author of A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times, and other books. Thank you very much for your 2 hours.
Well, thank you. Great to be with you.
Peace, brother. And Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, thank you very much for all you do. And please keep in mind that some people might want a Christmas bonus this year.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
I don't know.
I'm just throwing that out there.
God bless you, Si.
All right, you too, Chris. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.